Welcome to Jacobin Radio. I'm Susie Wiseman. On today's program, we spend the hour with Ilya Matveyev to get his insights and analysis of the recent so-called election giving Putin a fifth term in power, an election that was stage-managed and fraudulent with the exact result ordered from above. What was the point? Repression and persecution of critical voices against the war in Ukraine and Kremlin policy have been stepped up dramatically, as has nationalist and anti-Western propaganda. The independent media has been silenced. Public displays of opposition are immediately stopped and critics detained with growing sentences in prison. The economy hasn't tanked, and the war has provided a source for military Keynesianism. Yet Matveyev insists that Putin's being able to order an exact electoral result is a sign of weakness, not one of stability. The horrific terror attack of March 22nd underscores that Putin is not managing everything. We'll get Ilya Matveyev's analysis of the character of Putin's autocratic dictatorial rule. Is it Bonapartist, authoritarian, oligarchic capitalist, Stalinist, fascist, or? Well, we'll get his take when our program returns in just a moment. Welcome to Jacobin Radio. I'm Susie Wiseman and very pleased to have Ilya Matveyev back with us. And we're going to be talking about Russian elections, Russian society, Russian politics, Russian economy, and even the terror attack on Moscow. So let's just begin with Putin just won his fifth term in the Russian elections that have shown to be both fraudulent and meaningless, as Ilya has pointed out. Putin ordered a certain turnout and got a certain result. And Ilya Matveyev is a chronic tweeter. And he tweeted, Putin may be content with the North Korean percentage he himself ordered, but that is no indication of the stability or potential longevity of his regime. And Putin may well assume that everything is going well for him. The economy has not tanked. The war is going, let's say, somewhat better or at least manageable for Russia, and opponents are being jailed. And independent media has been silenced. Street demonstrations are nearly impossible. And any public display of political opposition is immediately snuffed out. Thousands of Russians have been prosecuted for criticizing the war or criticizing Kremlin policy. But as you've written, Ilya, even with 1,000% inflation and Ukrainian tanks besieging Belgorod, Putin can still choose any electoral result that he likes. So we're going to get Ilya Matveyev's analysis of Russia today in this new period of Putin's autocratic dictatorial rule. We'll also talk about how Ilya characterizes Russia today: fascist, Stalinist, Bonapartist, authoritarian, oligarchic, capitalist. We're going to get his take. So let me just tell you before I welcome you back to the show, Ilya Matveyev is a political scientist, formerly based in St. Petersburg, and he's currently a visiting scholar at UC Berkeley. He specializes in Russian politics and political economy. He's a founding member editor of Open Left RU and a member of the research group Public Sociology Laboratory, and he also collaborates with the media project Posly, which means after or what next. And his podcast, along with Ilya Budryatskis, is called Political Diary. So welcome to the show, Ilya.
Yeah, thank you.
I'm always happy to talk to you. And before we dive into that analysis, though, that I hinted that we're going to get to about the election and Putin's rule, I think we have to start with the terror attack on March 22nd at a concert hall on the outskirts of Moscow, Crocus City Hall. And it's one that U.S. intelligence and Western intelligence warned Moscow was imminent a few weeks ago. Now there's at least, I don't know, maybe 140, maybe 150 dead and many more injured. What's interesting is that the Islamic State of Khorasan Province, or the ISKP, has claimed credit for this deadly attack, but that didn't stop Putin or his henchmen from trying to blame Kyiv and used the attack as a justification for escalation of the war on Ukraine. And this came before any official investigation, and Russian propagandists have taken it even further, demanding Russian retaliation, not just on all of Ukraine, but Western capitals as well. And I just, you know, I went on Telegram and I looked at some of these crazy things that Russian officials were saying. Medvedev has turned out to be the most loudmouth and horrific. He says, if it's established that these are terrorists of the Kiev regime, it's impossible to deal with them and their ideological inspirers differently. All of them must be found and mercilessly destroyed as terrorists. Others have said that this is not just something that was organized by Kiev, but Russia should also bomb Paris and London. You know, some of the stuff that's being said is absolutely crazy. So, Ilya, let's begin with your thoughts on this attack and whether you think that Putin will be able to use it to his advantage, as it seems he's trying to do. And maybe when you talk about it too, tell me what you think is different in this attack, say, from the previous ones, like in Beslan or in the concert or in the theater hall years ago.
Mm-hmm. So first of all, the death toll, it's the biggest one since Beslan. So since 2004, and in fact, it was really the most horrible terrorist attack in the last 20 years in terms of death toll. It was absolutely just devastating the way these four people managed to kill so many people in this concert hall, you know, with automatic rifles, and also they put the whole building on fire, and a lot of people simply suffocated. Right. So it was a combination of fire, of rifle rounds, of suffocation, of being poisoned by the gases. So it's really just horrible. I really don't want to speculate in terms of who did it. But to me, it's kind of logical that the United States said before that there's going to be a terrorist attack. They said so publicly. They also informed the Russian authorities privately, and they, Putin, publicly brushed off this suggestion. He said it's just blackmail from the United States. For some reason, he said blackmail. Why is it blackmail? You know, it's just informing him about the imminent terror attack. So he just brushed it off. And then it happened, you know. And then United States immediately said that ISIS is responsible, some new reincarnation, you know, the thing that survived. And this thing itself, ISIS itself, claimed responsibility. So I think this fits together, this whole story fits together. So for Putin, obviously, this would be a huge disadvantage to agree with this story. Because what does it mean? It means that Putin created this enemy for Russia by interfering in Syria. You see, in the very fact that ISIS attacked Russia was because Russia interfered in Syria and fought ISIS. So supposedly this was a successful intervention because ISIS in Syria was destroyed and Assad regime won the civil war. So like previously in Russia, this whole thing was presented as a success because they managed to achieve these goals. And then suddenly we have this horrible terrorist act that is some kind of echo of Russia's Syrian intervention. So in my opinion, this is probably the truth, that this is actually ISIS or some new version of ISIS. But for Putin, obviously, this is politically, it's going to be very difficult to agree with this truth. And so he tries to spin the Ukrainian connection. Really, there is, at this point, nothing to indicate that it was in any way connected with Ukraine. Only the fact that these suspected terrorists were moving in the direction of Ukraine, and they were apprehended, you know, in the forest near the road that went to Ukraine, but still it was not that near the border, Ukrainian border. It's not like it was right on the border, right? And there are actually a lot of questions about this whole thing, about their apprehension. This is also a very strange story where you have some gruesome details that some guy cut off like ear tip of one of those suspected terrorists. And it turns out that this guy is probably a neo-Nazi because he has dispatches of some, you know, extreme far-right elements within the Russian army. So what was he doing there? And were these guys even the terrorists Like, who are these people? It's not clear. At this point, my personal confidence in Russian law enforcement is zero. So I just don't believe that these people are who the Russian state claims they are. So who were these people? And also, even if they were moving towards the Ukrainian border, it is possible that they could do it without coordinating with Ukraine. So simply they could escape to Ukraine because the border itself is, it's a front line. So there's a possibility to somehow escape to Ukraine and then go further west, for instance. So it wasn't like an escape route for them. But that does not indicate coordination with Ukraine. In general, really, the evidence that this is somehow connected to Ukraine is practically non-existent. But the evidence that this is connected to ISIS is pretty strong. So this is my general impression.
I think you're right about that. And what's interesting is that it just adds a challenge that Putin probably didn't imagine. And now he's going to have to contend with it. And that's one of the things that I want to get into in this analysis of Russia. And it's sort of like the weak points of the regime, in a sense. And this is contrary to what most people think. But let's just go into the elections now. For the listeners, the elections were concluded on March 17th. It gave Putin a fifth term in power. And this has been described, this election, as the most, let's call it performative or stage managed in all of the elections so far. Putin needed this show of support and legitimation. So it's clear that he ordered the result that he got. And here's another interesting thing. Putin has always cheated, even when he was genuinely popular and had no need to cheat in the early 2000s, but he cheated anyway. And that sort of begs the question, why? And I think Western observers, I remember reading, and I'm thinking this is back when he was going for his second or third term, that, there were a lot of dead souls that voted. There was stuffing of ballot boxes. Ballot boxes in Chechnya gave him 100%, right after he had carpet bombed Grozny, and people were saying, but there were no ballot boxes anywhere, but yet he got so many. So it just seems crazy. And I don't know if it's a sign of insecurity or of need. I'm sure you'll be able to tell us. So maybe you could begin, Ilya Matveyev, by giving us an overview of the election, its result, and its function.
Right, so first of all, I noticed that a lot of people still treat this as an election. Most of the people somehow recognized that it was probably rigged, but still there is this tendency in Western press, and unfortunately, especially among left-wing people, to treat these elections as actual elections, And this is just a mistake. It's not true. So these are not elections in any sense, because 87% of the vote is absurd. It was also proven statistically that this kind of result was fabricated in its entirety. So the thing is that, political science in Russia, the study of electoral politics mostly turned into the study of electoral fraud because the elections in Russia, they're nothing but fraud at this point. So there are some very reliable techniques of detecting fraud. And one simple technique is to make this chart where you have turnout and you have the vote for Putin. And you see this strong relationship. So the bigger the turnout, the higher the vote for Putin, up to 100%. 100% vote for Putin, 100% turnout, like in Chechnya, where it's a stable thing. At every election, it's the same result, 100%. So Kadyrov does not, invent anything. So for him, it's just this is the way to go. So, I mean, if you look at this relationship, you see that it's just ballot stuffing. So in a few, very few places in Russia where there was some semblance of fair counting of votes, there you have much lower turnout and also lower percentage for Putin, right? And then it goes up and up and up and up and up until 100%. So just looking at this chart, it's immediately clear that this was all fabricated. And then you also see these curious lines like too many electoral districts reporting the same results. Let's say 75%, 75% vote, 75% turnout. How can 1,000 districts report exactly the same numbers? Like, why, what kind of magic is that? So this whole thing just falls apart. And by the way, the reason that they do it is that it's a bureaucratic process. It's not some kind of creative process. So they are sent some target results. If the target is, let's say, 85%, they're not going to invent anything. They're going to say, let's say, 84.5% or 85.5%. That's it, right? So this is going to be in this interval. And so in this way, you see these spikes, you know? So 85%, a spike, 90%, a spike, 95%, a spike. So in like it's clear that this is just a bureaucratic process of writing the numbers instead of actually counting the votes. So these are not elections. These are not elections in any sense. And these should be recognized because I see this tendency to say, oh, you know, yes, maybe these elections were a little rigged, but in fact, people still would have voted for Putin if these were fair elections. I mean, this doesn't make sense. Let's have fair elections first, and then we'll see who is going to vote for whom. So there were two candidates, as you know, who tried to get on the ballot. They were not radical at all, and
Right.
they were very, very moderate, but they had a rather clear anti-war message. So what happened was first, it was Ekaterina Dunцова, who is a very interesting, actually, civic activist from Rzhev, a small town in central Russia. I think in normal circumstances, she would have huge potential for public politics. So she's very talented and she's very dedicated. But she has no political experience. She
Yeah.
was like a municipal deputy, so like a very, very small scale activity. And then she decided to try and put herself on the ballot for presidential election. So what happened was this explosion of activity around her. Like in the span of several days, it was like 200,000 people on her Telegram channel. Really, it was just an explosion of activity. And then she was blocked from
Right.
participating. In just 2 weeks, she was blocked. Then there was another guy, Boris Nadezhdin. He was even more moderate than Dunцова. So in
I
fact, he
like
was.
too, if I could just say that his name means hopeful. So it was sort
Yeah,
of like
yeah.
he was the total
Ironic.
symbol. Yeah, ironic.
Yeah.
Go ahead, sorry.
Absolutely, yeah. And so, and his name, and also surprisingly, he was also quite good playing this role of an opposition candidate, even though in fact he's semi-establishment politician. So he was a member of the Duma of Russian Parliament even during Putin's period. So he's not, I mean, he's kind of a liberal, but he's semi-establishment. And he decided to try to have anti-war message as well. So there was an explosion of activity around him as well. So people basically moved to Nadezhdin and they really wanted to help his campaign, to volunteer, and so on. And then he was also blocked from participating. So what kind of election is that? If one person blocked, another person blocked, until only the people without, so first of all, people who never said anything bad against the war are left on the ballot, right? So they are not anti-war in any shape or form. And secondly, they're just complete unknowns. So
Yeah.
from the Communist Party, for instance, they took this guy. He's just, no one knows who he is. And that was deliberate, just a completely unknown person, so that he doesn't spoil Putin's huge victory. So, yeah, I mean, in terms of electoral fraud, in terms of blocking these two candidates, it's just not an election. It does not represent anything. So the point is that it should not be interpreted as a sign that things are going well in Russia. Like I said in this thread, so maybe the Russian economy is doing more or less okay. Maybe the situation is at the front line is kind of okay for Russia, but these elections have nothing to do with it. It's a completely fabricated thing. And the question is, why would Putin want to have 87%? It's a ridiculous number. And personally, I did not expect something like that. I thought it's going to be something like 80%, because 80% is still higher than his previous result. It's a kind of a more respectable figure. I mean, of course, it depends on how you look at it, but still, it's at least somewhat believable. But 87%, it's something like Bashar Assad in 2014, he had elections, that's 92%, right? So it's something like this. It's really, it brings him from the space of like these authoritarian regimes where there is at least a little bit of competition to these authoritarian regimes where there is zero competition, like no competition at all, like Central Asian countries, you know? So Nazarbayev in
Yeah.
Kazakhstan, at one point he had like 98% of the vote. So this is something like that. This is similar to Kazakhstan.
Well, you could even go back to Brezhnev. You know,
Yeah.
there you would get forced to vote. People had to leave their jobs to go vote. Let me ask you another question about this too, because it does beg the question of what kind of legitimation Putin thinks that this gives him. And I noticed that Budryatskis called this election a form of collective violence against the population, with participation as a mandatory test of loyalty. Your job or your place in the university depended on whether or not you voted. So it was literally mandatory voting in this sense. Could you talk a little bit about that and what it's really the question of why he needed it?
So this kind of fake election with this kind of result brings this sense of hopelessness that nothing is possible in a situation where there is such an overwhelming control of the population. And this is a demonstration of power internally, but also externally. So to me, this is not only about the Russian society, it's also about the West. So it's a kind of show off that he's just indicating that, look, I have this ridiculous result, which is clearly stolen, which just doesn't have anything to do with reality, but you are still going to recognize this election because at some point there are going to be negotiations and you will need to negotiate with me, right? And because of that, you are going to recognize this election. You are not going to say that we do not recognize Putin as president. And this is exactly what happened. And the reason he's so confident is that it's not only about the war itself, it's also about nuclear weapons. Like Russia, there will be some kind of negotiation with Putin at some point, simply because he is too dangerous not to negotiate with. And based on this, he's just showing off. He's demonstrating, like, look, I can have any percentage I want, and you won't be able to do anything to me. So you're not going to say that I'm an illegitimate ruler, anything like that, because you are going to negotiate with me. Therefore, you cannot say these things. Otherwise, it doesn't make sense. What kind of negotiation is possible with a person who is not legitimate, right? So, yeah, so it's also kind of a flex directed at the West, not just at the Russian society, but also internally. The idea is to demonstrate that it is some kind of monolithic thing, that the opposition is completely marginal. So it's almost non-existent. That is his point, that he wants to demonstrate that people who are against himself, against the war, it's just a very, very small group. It's on the margins. Because even when we had 2020 constitutional amendment vote, right? So this vote to allow Putin to stay in power. So it was 75%. And Putin said publicly, yes, 25% of people voted no. And we recognize that there is this group, it's only 25%, but at least we kind of recognize its existence and they maybe have some rights, something like this. You know, we're not going to send them to concentration camps right now because they are part of Russian society, something like this. And what he demonstrates now is that there is no such group as 25% of people who are against the war, against Putin. So the number of such people is near zero because 87% of people supported Putin personally and others supported basically the same thing because he had this rally where he stood with all three candidates and he forced all three of them to say, Vladimir Putin, congratulations with becoming president. We fully support you. So if you vote for other people, you also kind of support Putin, but in a different way. So that was his idea. To make this impression of a completely monolithic situation where there is no group of opposition.
It's also the case that Putin never names his opposition. He only mentioned Navalny's name once. And when Kagarlitsky, when it was brought up in I think it was a Valdai conference, somebody said something about Kagarlitsky and he pretended ignorance. Maybe he was ignorant of it. But I'd like to talk just a little bit about the drastically increased repression, and especially in the lead up to the election, that there was, fierce repression to silence any critics and any protests. Of course, we know that Navalny was killed on February 19th. Kagarlitsky's sentence was reversed on appeal. He was put in jail for 5 years. Well, Anton Orlov and many others who are prominent or less prominent anti-war critics have all been jailed. And then even so, given this horrific atmosphere, thousands of people showed up to lay flowers, at the funeral of Navalny. And there was widely photographed, and now we have reports that they're visiting the homes of people who they identify, and they're either arresting them or warning them. And so it's just a really, terrible thing. And then before we came on the air, you discussed, when you voted, that showing up at noon, and this was Navalny's call to show a protest that there would be a noon vote, and everybody should vote for anybody other than Putin. And show up at noon. And even that was a brave act. Oh, and then we also, of course, we had pictures of, we saw scenes of people spoiling ballots and getting arrested. There is a brave sort of resistance. And I say brave because there's no result other than going to jail, perhaps being beaten up, and in the worst of circumstances, being killed. So can you talk a little bit about the efforts to show that there's still some resistance and the efforts to crush it?
So I would take on one thing you said, people spoiling their ballots and then getting arrested. It's true. It's when you think about it, it's extremely crazy that what this person did was write something on the ballot, like Navalny's name, or Putin is a crook, or Putin is a murderer, or something like that. And then he puts the ballot into the ballot box, and then the policeman, all the electoral voting stations, they all have policemen present. So this policeman immediately arrests this person. I mean, it's really, this is why Ilya wrote that these elections are collective violence, because if you do something wrong during the elections, you are arrested. So there is this thing from Dictator by Sacha Baron Cohen, where they have these two lines of people, and then there's like a tank moving in, and all these people join the first line, and then they vote for this dictator, right? So it's something like this.
Brilliant.
The thing is, I'm thinking about it a lot, obviously, and my conclusion is that not only is repression in Russia like extreme in terms of scale, in terms of intensity, but also I think that it is now the primary thing that sustains the regime. So it's the most important thing because propaganda, for instance, it's clearly secondary, even though all Russian media is propaganda at this point. It's like Nazi Germany, there are no newspapers that have some independent line or anything like that. So there is independent media outside of the country, right? But within Russia, all media is propaganda. Still, this is a secondary thing because propaganda, people become numb to repetition. So if you repeat the same thing over and over and over again, people do not respond to this. And also, the war itself becomes a point of frustration. So clearly, people are tired and frustrated because of the war and this huge toll that it has on the Russian society. And propaganda is not that effective at this point. But the thing is, there is no way to express your frustration because of this well-oiled repressive machine. So it works really like clockwork. There's an article about not even criminal cases, but administrative cases against people who said something wrong about Putin or the war in one region, in Siberia. So, and it's just a description of this routine. For instance, like you talked to your coworkers and said something wrong about the war, and then some of them reported you, and at first you get a fine as a recognition that they know that you said did something wrong. And also they might force you to have this public apology recorded on the video. Like you have to say, I recant my words, I respect Vladimir Vladimirovich, special military operation is great. And then if you don't comply, these two administrative charges equal one criminal charge. And you have the possibility to go to prison if you do something like this again. And it becomes a routine. There are dozens and dozens of cases like that. A person said something, person took a poster off the wall, it's a fine, and then it's a prison sentence. So these are real cases. The person made some graffiti, took a flag from some patriotic demonstration, just took a flag from some other person's hands. So all these immediately is targeted. even the smallest acts of resistance, they're immediately targeted by the authorities, especially in places like Moscow, where you have artificial intelligence and CCTV cameras. They don't even need to film you when you take some action. So this is just recorded on CCTV. And then they arrest you when you go to the metro station. Some other camera recognizes you, and then the police at the metro station apprehend you. So it really works in the scary, scary way. And so repression becomes the primary thing within the regime. It's the most important thing. So economic performance and propaganda ideology, it's secondary to repression, because people might reproduce these propaganda narratives, but only out of fear. So they understand there is nothing for them to do, and they decide, okay, so if I can't do anything, then basically I have to agree with what they're saying, that I have to somehow find a way to agree with this narrative, even though they don't want to. So this is how propaganda works at this point. There is no enthusiasm, there is no real support. It's more just people are forced into this propaganda narrative. And so this is the state of Russian society. Unfortunately, this kind of violence works, and it's not like this regime is going to fall because propaganda becomes less effective, because violence is apparently a very effective instrument of control.
I wanted to comment on this because it's striking to me and dramatic. I spent more than a decade just wrapped up in the 1930s in Russia and reading everything I could and trying to understand the nature of Stalinism and Stalinist repression. Also, I should preface it by saying I never thought that kind of thing would happen again once the Soviet Union disintegrated. And now we're seeing it. It's almost as if Putin is borrowing Stalin's playbook, which is to say that he will brook no opposition, even imagined opposition, and that any dissent is going to be criminalized and the population is going to be atomized. And it really, really sort of speaks to the inner weakness of the Putin regime, just as it did to the Stalin regime, having to resort to repressing so many people. It's not at all at the numbers now. Putin is selective, Stalin was massive. But it is striking that he's using this same playbook and in a very different set of circumstances and a very different society. And I'd love to hear your comment on that.
In terms of the scale and the type of repression, it is still not Stalinism, but at the same time, it kind of approaches Stalinism because these are now hundreds of thousands of cases. If you count all instances of repression, like administrative proceedings, like some fines, some small jail terms, and firing people from work. So if you count everything, it's in the hundreds of thousands. So it's a massive, massive process. And the point is the same. It's a totalitarian point of trying to control everything in society. So, like, this
Right.
was Stalin's
Thank you.
approach. So, there should be no dissent at all, no organized dissent, not even individual dissent. So, this is what Putin tries to do at this moment. But, I mean, is it a weakness or not? It's a question, because Stalin was the longest serving ruler in the last 150 years, or maybe longer even. And Putin is approaching this number, actually,
Think he
Stalin.
wants to beat it. I think he's in
Yeah.
competition. But and I
Yeah.
want to say too that there are some people who say, and I think I read it, that sources within the administration are saying that Putin now plans to mobilize 300,000 more soldiers and try to besiege Kharkiv and other places. So, I mean, do you see that as he feels further legitimized to be able to escalate the war on Ukraine?
I think so. I think his idea is that elections have passed, and now it's time to do something unpopular, because there is now a possibility to do that, that he doesn't need to pretend that everything is going great. And as you remember, after previous elections, he raised the retirement age. So this was calculated to happen right after elections. And it was a very dramatic move, because everyone in Russia opposed it. It was deeply, deeply unpopular. And so he waited until after the elections, and then he did it. And so the same logic kind of applies with mobilization. So I think he will try to do it in a more covert way. So not an open mobilization, but more like piecemeal policies. So he can take some people who served in the army before. He can also force some people, like some young people, to sign these contracts with the army after their conscription has ended. So this is going to be like a piecemeal process. And probably he will be able to achieve this target, 300,000 people. At the same time, I mean, this is still not enough to besiege Kharkiv. It's such a huge city, it's so well defended that this is going to be an operation comparable to Stalingrad. At this point, with the state of Ukrainian army, I don't believe that even 300,000 soldiers will be able to do it. And the smaller goal is to create this buffer zone within the Kharkiv Oblast, within the Kharkiv region, so that he pushes Ukrainian troops from the Russian borders. But this is still a huge offensive operation. And I think that all indications are that there's going to be some kind of covert mobilization and some kind of new offensive.
So let's go from there to the economy, because this is something that you mentioned. For example, there's 1,000% inflation. The United States imposed what they thought were draconian but selective sanctions, and the sanctions seem to have not done all that much. I mean, there's some, criticism of that, but the other side of it is that the war itself has created new production for war materiel, and that certainly boosted the economy. The United States is a good test case of a military industrial state, you could call it in some ways. So I guess the question I really want, or I'd like to hear your thoughts about the nature of the economy, why it's doing better than expected, how have the sanctions worked or not worked, what is the inflation, what is the state of the population and consumption, even just the fact that, well, we'll go into it, that the public sector is huge. I want to hear your ideas about this.
Right. So my point about 1,000% inflation was hypothetical. So, like,
Okay.
actual inflation in Russia is quite low. It's manageable, and this is another important point that this year it's probably under 10%, maybe even under 5%. Yeah, it is sort of surprising because even my own prediction at the beginning of the war was that there's going to be a, if not collapse, then huge decline in the Russian economy. But apparently, this just demonstrates that there are ways to import stuff. If you really want to import goods, you will find a way to do it. And the crucial question is the money. And apparently, the steady supply of money from oil exports and in energy exports is maintained because the West decided that Russian oil is too important for the global economy to completely, eliminate it. And so, some media say that Russia is now the most sanctioned economy in the world. I mean, technically, it's kind of true if you look at the number of sanctions. But it's not really true in the sense of severity, because Iran is more sanctioned than Russia. Like, Iranian oil is completely banned. You cannot trade Iranian oil at all. And Russian oil, you can actually trade. It is legal if there is an oil price cap. So this oil price cap, it's a contradictory sanction. It's a contradictory measure because they, on the one hand, they want to lower Russian profits from energy trade. On the other hand, they allow Russia to sell oil, do it legally, and even earn a bit of profits from it, right? So it's kind of what kind of sanction regime is that? And the reason for this very moderate approach is that no one wants for the price of oil to go up, to have this extreme spike in the price of oil, because Russia really controls a huge chunk of the global oil market. And there was this collective implicit decision that Russian oil needs to be present in the world, and this creates revenue flow for Putin. And if he has this revenue flow, everything else is solvable. Another thing is that apparently this military Keynesian policy is very effective. So this military mobilization of the economy is very effective, and in a way, this is another proof that neoliberal kind of recipes do not really work in terms of generating growth. And a kind of classic Keynesian industrial policy move is still able to generate growth and generate employment. So Russia now is close to full employment. And this creates pressure on wages, and employers have to fight for workers, and so they increase the wages. And so there was truly an increase in real wages in Russia. It was not that big, but it is still noticeable. And combined with full employment, this creates a dynamic economic situation. So the biggest limit is government spending. Like with any Keynesian regime, it's about government spending. And there's a danger that spending gets out of control. They constantly need to stimulate the economy with new spending. And so this creates debt. And if the debt is too high, then the whole kind of budget system collapses. So debt is the biggest danger here. But somehow, with this oil revenue and energy revenue, they managed to keep the debt under control because Russian government, like, the economic block of the Russian government, is very skillful. And in this way, it all kind of fits into place. You know, there is a dynamic industrial situation. There is almost full employment, and in fact, a shortage of workers. There is the growth of salaries, and all the imports can be substituted, or, you know, there's a way to find another country to import the goods for you. And all of these post-Soviet countries like Georgia and Armenia and Kazakhstan, suddenly they have these spikes in different categories of goods because they all go
Wow.
to Russia eventually, right?
That
So
is really, I want you to go into that a little bit more, because that was a key point, and people thought, well, maybe it's China that's doing it, but everything is so closely monitored. And yet, when I think back to the Yeltsin regime, and when there was, wage arrears of a year sometimes or more, and yet people came up with the most ingenious schemes to trade, on a very large scale, goods in order to keep the economy going without money. And so now we're seeing that there's a real an ingenious way to get around the imports.
Right, but there's also, it's an important demonstration of the limits of America's economic power, because ultimately it all comes down to financial power. It's all about the dollar, and it's absolutely true that dollar's status as reserve currency gives American authorities this huge, huge power, because that means that, for instance, no bank in the world can work with Russian rubles if they also want to work with dollars. And if this bank does not work with dollars, what kind of bank is it where you cannot have a dollar account, right? So it doesn't make sense to have this kind of bank. So if you want to have dollar accounts, you are going to comply with American sanctions, American financial sanctions. And this is very, very strong leverage. I'm not even going to deny it. And I'm not the person who would say, oh, you know, the dollar's era is ending, and dollar is not going to be reserve currency anymore. So it doesn't work this way. But there are limits to this approach as well. And Russia just demonstrates these limits. For instance, China needs Russian oil and natural gas. And Russia needs industrial products, especially advanced industrial products like mechanical engineering tools and cars and stuff like that, right? So based on this, there could be trade in rubles and yuan. And so now, like 95% of the trade between Russia and China is done in rubles and yuan, not with dollars. This is a huge, huge trade in terms of volume. It's $240 billion in last year alone. So it's a huge number. And this trade itself demonstrates this alternative to dollar dominance. At least for a single country like Russia, it's possible to kind of avoid dealing with dollars altogether and still survive. And I think this demonstrates the actual limit of the sanctions approach and limits on this, ability to weaponize economic ties. Because with the financial sphere, you have this situation where rubles can be used, yuan can be used. And with commodities, you have to recognize that Russian oil is important for the world. And same goes for grain, for instance. You cannot avoid Russian grain from reaching its customers, because the world needs Russian grain, Russian agricultural products, and the same with fertilizer. And so these things, they're inescapable. So the world needs these products. Therefore, Russia is going to have some profits, some stream of revenue. Therefore, it's going to finance the war, unfortunately. So this all demonstrates the limits of the sanction approach.
Really interesting, Ilya. I wanted to just, I guess, have us wrap up with a discussion of how you characterize this regime. As you were speaking, I was getting progressively more depressed in the sense that, pointing out the success with which, Putin not only managed this election, which is not an election, but the way that he manages power, but also now the way he manages, and I shouldn't just say Putin, the Kremlin, let's say, manages the economy. And at the same time that I said that there's an inner weakness to the regime, that any regime that resorts to this kind of repression, is weak. And you have pointed to the weakness of the regime and also to the flimsiness of its attempts, to show its power. And that you've also said that it's not only politically weak, but militarily weak. Maybe that's no longer the case. And you've described it as a Bonapartist regime, not an oligarchic capitalist one. I think Ilya Budryatskis calls it the Putin regime a modern fascist one. And his elections, as we said, a form of collective violence. And perhaps all of these characterizations are true, but I want to get your explanation of how you see it.
Right,
Big question.
so Bonapartism is a great Marxist concept, and it was certainly applicable to especially early years of Putin's rule, because Bonapartism is about building the state that it is so powerful that it can dominate social classes, including bourgeoisie, including the capitalist class. So the state becomes even more powerful than the capitalist class. In that sense, it is still a Bonapartist regime. But also, according to Marx, it's about maneuvering between different classes. So Bonapartism is not all powerful. It's actually a regime that is very flexible. It maneuvers between workers and capitalists and some lumpen proletariat. So there are many different bases of support. And I think it's not true anymore about Putin, about this regime. So there's not much maneuvering going on. It's just a complete domination. So it's just too repressive to be Bonapartist. So, like, Bonapartist regime is also repressive. It is an authoritarian regime. But I think that we are past this point where it can be called Bonapartist. Fascism was also called Bonapartism by Marxist scholars, but I think it's a kind of duplication of terms. And what is important about the fascist characterization is that the regime tries to mobilize people in unprecedented ways and tries to get into their heads, indoctrinate them completely, and to replace all social organizations with its own pro-regime organizations. So there's not going to be trade unions, women's groups, nothing like that. It's all going to be controlled by the Nazi party, let's say. And indoctrination is systemic. I think this particular point makes it similar to Russia at this moment. So Russia is fascist or becoming fascist in the sense that indoctrination is becoming systemic. For instance, the education system is just penetrated by propaganda. So every week, all students in Russia, all teachers in Russia, they participate in these propaganda lessons with the curriculum developed in a centralized manner. And for instance, I studied this lesson about the annexation of Crimea. And it's basically a lesson in nationalism. So the lesson consists of describing the annexation of Crimea as historic justice being done, and Russia is somehow entitled to Crimea. It has to be ours, and everyone else has to agree with it. And this is the birthplace of Russian civilization, and then all kinds of nationalist myths connected to Crimea. So this is really a lesson in nationalism in all Russian schools. And this is not just an authoritarian regime. This is a fascist regime in that sense, that indoctrination reaches every nook and cranny in society. And it's not just conservatism, traditional values, just anti-LGBT and so on, even though the situation is terrible with that at the moment. So really, the recent news were like administrators of a gay bar were sentenced to 10 years in prison for being extremists. But it's not just about this. It's also about the image of the external enemy and this idea of the need to constantly fight this external enemy. So it's not just conservatism, it's also a kind of aggressive imperialist nationalist set of ideas that is being pushed everywhere. So, and this is the point of calling this regime fascist, because it's not just authoritarianism that is content with people, sitting at home, doing something, with doing their private lives. Now it's trying to mobilize the people.
I want to ask several questions about that. One is that how is that external enemy characterized? I mean, we saw that Putin said when he went into Ukraine that he was going to denazify it as if it was run by Nazis. You mentioned it's Russian nationalism, it's great Russian chauvinism. First, who is that enemy? And then just a little bit more on the character, because fascism, Nazism was a totalitarian system. I would have characterized Stalinism as a kind of attempt to be totalitarian, but they could never get control of the economic mechanism. And so they could never completely control every aspect of the society as much as they tried. And it depended on the complete atomization of every individual whose every part of their life was dependent on the whims of the state. There's some aspect of it we saw when Putin came to power. He was very popular because he reined in the power of these oligarchs and brought them under state control again in a funny way. It's a funny form of capitalism where it's politically controlled. It's not like, let's call it the way political capitalism works for upward redistribution of wealth dependent on your political position here. It's almost direct, I think, isn't it? So can you maybe just explain a little bit more? We have a little bit of time.
What to explain exactly from this?
Well, I want to understand a little bit more the Kremlin control of the economy, even though it's capitalist. So, how does that work? And then I also want to know a little bit more about the efforts. Let's say during fascism, there was a mass movement. Here we have mass propaganda, and you said it's creating an external enemy. How is that external enemy, characterized? We have about 3 minutes.
So I think that a lot of Marxists make this mistake about Nazi regime. They say that it's basically an expression of the interests of the ruling class, and somehow even Hitler himself was simply serving the interests of the German bourgeoisie, German big business. This is not true. And German business was dominated by politics. And Hitler's statements about the primacy of politics should be taken at face value, because this is what he achieved: a complete domination of politics, political sphere, and specifically the Nazi Party over big business in Germany. And in fact, the last years of German regime were really detrimental to big business. So this whole thing was moving towards the abyss, and no businessman could do anything with it. And this is kind of the same in Russia. So it's a complete domination of big business by the state. So yes, you have businessmen, you have corporate structures, you have accumulation strategies, you have kind of private property in a way. It's limited, it's conditioned, but it's still private property. But it is completely dominated by politics. It's just dominated by Putin's dictatorial regime. He manages to find ways for this whole thing to be profitable to big business. But at the same time, I mean, it's not as profitable as before 2014, for instance. So really, the golden era of Russian oligarchs ended in 2014. And now it's difficult for them to earn money when they're disconnected from the global financial system, global kind of, the center of global capitalism. So they still find ways to earn money, and Putin helps them to find ways to earn money. But it is not as profitable as before. So yeah, the mistake here is to assume that the ruling class is still somehow ruling, even though it doesn't seem that way, that somehow they're still in control. It's not true. They're not in control. Russian business is not in control. It is subordinated to Putin, and Putin is in control. And it's important to understand, because a lot of left-wing analysis, they have this axiomatic way of approaching this, that if something happens, then it's because of big business. But it doesn't work that way. In reality, it doesn't work that way. And especially in Russia, it doesn't work that way.
Really interesting. So finally, on the external enemy, is it just the West? Is it what is it?
Right. It's, I mean, It's difficult to describe because it's always shifting, this idea. So it's the West, but also it's so-called Anglo-Saxons, you know, this new famous phrase by Putin. So it's not all of the West. It's Britain and America, they're especially bad, and I guess Canada as well for some reason. So and Australia, all the Anglo-Saxons. So they're the center of evil. And the idea is that the West being the enemy is the constant. It's the permanent thing. Then there can be ultimately no reconciliation. So this battle between Russia and the West is an internal battle, and there's not going to be any kind of reconciliation with the West. So the West is defined as the enemy. No matter what they do, no matter what they say, they are going to be the enemy. And I think it became like that even before the war. And this is actually one of the causes of the war, that Putin's idea of the West, you know, that the West is the enemy, no matter what they actually do, no matter the negotiations and, you know, some diplomatic process, it doesn't matter. There is this constant thing that the West is the enemy of Russia. And the West wants to destroy Russia. That's Putin's basic assumption, that the West wants to destroy Russia, and they will do anything in their power to do this. And the thing is that Putin himself believes this, but now they also want to indoctrinate the whole population into this narrative, that everyone should believe it, that the West is Russia's eternal enemy. So, and there should be some kind of consensus between the people and the Kremlin that the West is this eternal enemy.
This is really important because it obviously has to galvanize support in this way by keeping the population in fear of some kind of attack or something. And this is not new. This is, you know, back to what existed during the Cold War. So it's kind of frightening, but at the same time, we do see that there's thousands of people who don't think this way, and he needs repression to be able to enforce this.
But I think that Putin's ideology, in some ways, it is more rigid, it's more inflexible than the Soviet ideology, because in the Soviet Union there were periods of détente, of even some ideas of convergence between, you know, the Soviet system and the Western system. So at least theoretically, this could be you know, discussed, that actually, yes, we're very different from the West, but there is still some similarities, and it might not be an eternal situation, that we're destined to fight the West. And it was kind of more flexible. And at this point, it's almost a religious thing, that the West is evil in the religious sense for Putin and within this ideology. So it is more dangerous than the late Soviet ideology in that sense, I think.
I think I agree with you on that.
And I didn't mention is that just yesterday, this laboratory, public sociology laboratory, was declared a foreign agent in Russia. So this is going to have some legal repercussions, even though I'm not in Russia, but still it's kind of, you know,
You're going to have
there's
to be very
that.
careful, no matter where you are.
And I mean, it can create problems because these so-called foreign agents, they have to post this
Stupid thing, I know.
notice. And if you don't do that, there's a fine, and these fines can accumulate, and so all of your Russian properties can be eventually expropriated because of the fine. So yeah, so this can be a problem, but I think we'll find a way to somehow, you know, get around this. But yeah.
But even with your, if you're at, for you, for example, you're outside, even though you have to say, if you're declared a foreign agent, you have to say that.
I mean, like, at this point, it's not me personally, it's the laboratory.
The
So everything
laboratory, yeah.
related to past lab, we have to preface it with the notice. So if we don't do it, then they identified the organizers of the laboratory officially, and these are people from the website. And I'm just one of these people, right? And
Yeah.
they can place a fine on any of us. I don't understand
Right.
how. Or maybe on
Wow.
all of us, for
Yeah.
instance. And these are pretty huge fines. I mean, it could be up to $6,000 for each case of this kind of breach of this bullshit kind of, you know, rule.
Okay.
So, but I still have some Russian bank accounts, for instance, and that means that they can freeze my Russian bank accounts potentially. I mean, I'm describing the worst case scenario, that they can freeze my bank accounts. and they will probably not take my apartment in Petersburg, but still they can, mess with my Russian Sberbank account, which I still need
Jesus.
time to time. Yeah. So
Crazy,
this could be
crazy.
a problem. But there's another law that apparently allows to confiscate the property of people who discredit Russia from abroad. So it wasn't applied yet, but there is such a law. So potentially they can take your apartment away. So,
Jesus. This is
yeah.
all this new form of totalitarian control, right?
Actually,
Yeah.
yeah.
It's
It's, I mean, it's.
crazy.
It's not great, really. So like I have this apartment and I paid for the mortgage and I was paying for it for several years, and also my parents' money went into it, and now they can just take it away. So yeah, even though I'm not in Russia, still like people live in that apartment, they pay some rent. It's very small by Californian standards, but still it's something.
Can
So
you switch the title to your parents or something so that it doesn't
yeah.
happen?
There is like a suspicion that they might somehow cancel this kind of transfer of rights. Something like, I mean, I'm not exactly sure, but theoretically it's possible. Yes. And I think we'll do it at some point. So my mom already has this, how would you call it?
Power of attorney or something?
Yes, power of,
Yeah.
yeah, like
Yeah.
represent me in all these
Right.
situations. So I think she can transfer the rights or sell the apartment or do something like that. But still, it's like, yeah, it's not great.
I'm
Not
sorry.
great. Yeah.
Oh my God. We're going to have to end it here. We've run out of time, but you've given us so much to think about. And I hope that we can come back and maybe just discuss this on
Yeah.
the show. Ilya Matveyev, thank you so much for your insights and for your work. Ilya is a political scientist. He was formerly from St. Petersburg, but left right after the war. And is currently a visiting scholar at UC Berkeley. And as you can tell, he specializes in Russian politics and political economy. And he is now collaborating with Postly and also with Public Sociology Laboratory. And if you want to follow his constant thoughts that are always intriguing, look him up on Twitter. Ilya, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you.
Thank you. Thanks for listening. I'm your host, Susie Wiseman. This is Jacobin Radio. Thanks to producer and director Alan Minsky and to Jacobin Radio's Micah Utrecht. Bhaskar Sunkara is the founder and editor of Jacobin Magazine. And special thanks to Robert Brenner. And thanks to you for listening. I'm Susie Wiseman.